ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Just a warning. This episode of ABC Rewind includes the names and voices of Aboriginal people who have died. It's 1969, and Terry Foreman's about to graduate from Sydney Uni. He's studying agriculture, and he's stoked because he's just been selected to tour South Africa with Australia's rugby union team, the Wallabies.
From the time I was a child when I first started to play rugby, I remember hearing this story about the Springboks, and I thought, just as a child in your imagination, maybe they're different than us, you know, maybe they spring along and they sort of can jump.
Terry's seen the Springboks play. They're fast and powerful. But as excited as he is to fulfill his childhood dream, something's just not sitting right.
I didn't really know a lot about the political ins and outs of it. What I did know was that the coloured people in South Africa had very little rights, and they were sort of forced to live a separate social and working life. Through my father, really, he was there during the war. And I remember him saying to me, he said, "You won't like what you see there in terms of the people, exploitation of people."
Terry's got mates who've also been selected, and there's a bit of talk going on. Should we be doing this? Is travelling to an apartheid state the right thing to do? They start asking themselves hard questions. Do I step into the dream of playing for Australia? Or do I take a stand and boycott the tour?
And we certainly talked about it. And I think the general consensus was that we should go and see for ourselves. And also, I just had a feeling that I should go, you know.
It's the 1960s, so Terry knows about the civil rights movement in the United States. And he's keen to know more about black rights. So he slays some stereotypes and he spends the flight to South Africa reading a book of essays by the black gay writer James Baldwin. And when they land...
It was exciting, but as soon as you got a little bit away from that, you realised, you know, just even walking around the back streets or going to the post office, you see all the signs, whites only, blacks only, different seats. And that sort of thing started to become really disturbing.
The Wallabies spend 4 months touring South Africa, and every day, Terry's eyes are being opened. When he's on the rugby pitch, Terry notices something odd about the crowd.
All the coloured people were in a separate section and often surrounded by barbed wire. It was almost like stock put in a different yard.
It's incredibly unsettling. And then there are all these chaperoned side trips that South African rugby has planned for the team. One time, bizarrely, they're taken to visit a police station. And what Terry sees that day, it's seared in his memory.
Which was the police dog unit, showing us the way dogs were used to control African people because they're proud of the training of their German Shepherd dogs, you know.
The police give the Wallabies a demo of how they use the dogs.
And I remember some African people dressed up in almost like ice hockey goalkeeper's gear, you know, padding and shields and so on while the dogs were let loose on them.
Yes, you heard that right. Dogs being set on humans. Many, many black people in South Africa are still scared of dogs to this day for exactly this reason. Normal police dogs are used to sniff and detect crimes. Apartheid dogs are trained to attack.
Some of us just, when we realised what it was, we just turned and walked away from that as well.
The team's disgusted. Despite, or maybe because of these experiences, the tour is a game changer for some of those players.
I'm very pleased I went and saw it and experienced it and came back with a different view. And it was actually something that really changed my life.
Terry Foreman will go on to play a big part in the mighty Australian protest movement that challenges apartheid and holds white South Africa accountable. Years before governments take any action, before any formal sanctions against the apartheid regime, a formidable coalition of activists leads the way in saying, "Not in our name. This has to stop." This is Boycott, the fight to end apartheid. And I'm Sisonke Msimang, the daughter of a South African freedom fighter and a child of the anti-apartheid movement. I grew up in exile, unable to go home because of the racist South African regime that swept to power in 1948. and brutally divided our people based on the color of their skin. In the last episode, you heard about what it was like to live under apartheid.
Black and white can't marry. Certain jobs were only reserved for whites. Blacks can't do all the skilled jobs. All menial work was left to them. That's your lot in life. God said so.
After generations of peaceful protest by Africans, one of the darkest days in our history took place. The 1960 Sharpeville Massacre.
We just heard a loud shot from the gunfire. From there, it was all hell.
My photographer, Jan Hook, started shouting, their bodies all over.
When police murdered 69 black people at Sharpeville, it changed the way the world saw South Africa, and it changed South Africa. The leading political movement, the African National Congress, or ANC, is banned, and its leaders go underground. But the world is now watching, and activists around the globe start pushing back, finding ways to hit South Africa's apartheid government where it hurts most. And right here, in this country, activists take aim in a truly Australian arena, the sporting field. This is episode 2, Bloodsport. The Australian Wallabies and the South African Springboks are two of the best rugby union teams in the world. And the rivalry between them is fierce. Always has been.
They were probably always, in those days, the supreme rugby playing country, along with New Zealand.
Anthony Abrams plays lock for the Wallabies on that 1969 tour with Terry Foreman. If, like me, you have no idea what being a lock means, basically it means being tall and powerful, the key jumper in lineouts, and pushing hard in a scrum. Got it?
The rugby matches in South Africa are almost like Nuremberg rallies, an almost ecstatic or hysterical edge created by a people who felt their isolationism. They knew that their domination was under challenge, and that really translated onto the rugby field.
That sounds about right, because in South Africa, rugby isn't just a sport. It's a way of showcasing white superiority. Prime Minister John Foster.
Sport has always been played separately by the various races in South Africa, and so it will remain.
Prime Minister Foster there, emphasizing that there are black teams and there are white teams. And to have the honor of wearing a Springbok Guernsey, you have to be white. For white South Africans, the Springboks represent power and strength, white superiority. But for black South Africans, the whites-only team represents humiliation, the loss of land and rights, in other words, white supremacy. We black people also see that the government uses sport to normalize apartheid to the rest of the world, to soften its image. Because if white South Africans can be great sportsmen, surely they can't be monsters. Despite what some people might try to tell you, sport and politics, they can't easily be separated.
Once a jolly swagman can buy a pillow top under the shade of a coolie bar tree.
Let's take a step back to 1963. The Wallabies are en route to South Africa.
8,000 miles westward on the wings of a song. Just over 30 men already anticipating new experiences in a strange land, a sister country south of the line.
But before the rugby team even boards the plane, one of the Wallaby players pulls the plug. His name's Lloyd McDermott, and he wants nothing to do with playing in apartheid South Africa. Here's his daughter, Philippa McDermott.
My father was born in Eidsvold, which is a little town in central Queensland, and really lived the first years of his life on the station and then out bush with my grandparents and wider kind of clan group working, ring barking and what have you. So he basically lived in a tent till he was about 10 or 11, and he didn't go to school.
My anglicised name is Lloyd Clive McDermott. I also have taken on a tribal name called Mullinjawaka, which is a combination of the Mullinjali clan and the Waka Waka people.
The late Mullinjai Waka, Lloyd McDermott, is just the second Aboriginal man to play rugby union for Australia. and he should be on that plane to Johannesburg. But he's not, because there's a slight problem. Everyone knows South Africa won't allow black players on its team. But get this, it won't even allow black players on the field.
But when I realised I would have had to be acknowledged as some sort of honorary white for that period of the tour, the decision wasn't a hard one. I thought myself that we shouldn't have been playing. We should have had sporting sanctions at that stage. But that wasn't to be.
So essentially, Lloyd makes a huge decision. After playing just two tests for the Wallabies, he resigns. His international rugby union career is over, just as quickly as it began.
It was really a personal decision for Dad about not compromising his identity as an Aboriginal person. And for us and everything that we've been through and our families and families before that, he would never compromise his values, his identity. It's the essence of being for us. It's our birthright. Did end his rugby career. It had not only, you know, a political impact, but yes, it had a financial impact on Dad, but he did not let that hold him back.
And I don't hold anything out against the Wallabies and went and toured there, but I took the view that I could not go there and play in a segregated society. I don't regret that decision at all, and as history's proven, we were right.
Malanja Waka Lloyd McDermott will go on to become Australia's first Aboriginal barrister. So yes, history has absolutely proven him right. No doubt his experience growing up black in Australia has primed him for the role. In South Africa, the 1960s are referred to as the lost decade. Nelson Mandela and his comrades are either in prison or in exile. And the apartheid government has silenced any dissent in the wake of the Sharpeville massacre. But everywhere else in the world, change is in the air. There's war raging in Vietnam and protests along with it. The civil rights movement is blossoming. And in Australia, Indigenous people are finally recognized as citizens. So by the time the Wallabies set off on their 1969 tour, the world is starting to scrutinize South Africa. Anthony Abrams is a law student at Sydney Uni, and he's on the tour. Like Terry Foreman, he's tuned into world events. So when he's selected for the tour, he's conflicted. Should I go? Should I stay? Some friends advise him not to go. Why dignify apartheid? Others urge him to use it as a fact-finding mission. He decides to go. He'll play by day and investigate by night. It doesn't take long for racism to rear its head. Anthony can see it on the pitch.
There was a relatively small enclosure where blacks were allowed, and they were hemmed in by high barbed wire, and there were police dogs and truncheons to intimidate them if they got unruly, unruly being if they supported us too vociferously, and because they used to go mad every time we scored a try.
The black people in the stand are doing exactly what I did my whole life when I watched sport, supporting any team except South Africa. It just would have been absurd to support a national team that excluded us. And off the field, Anthony is using his time wisely. He's doing his homework. He talks to political leaders, to writers, to journalists.
Whilst I was fulfilling very diligently my training obligations and playing obligations, I was carrying out this sort of parallel agenda of using my badge and the tie in order to get behind doors where people who were very central to the South African opposition could be spoken to.
South African rugby is in full propaganda mode. They're carting the Wallabies around to attend a bunch of events, like that police dog demo, trying to convince them that black people are happy and love apartheid. The rugby tour ends, the Wallabies lose 4-0, and Anthony Abrams decides to stay on in South Africa. It's a harrowing journey. As he makes his way north by land towards what is then Rhodesia, today Zimbabwe, he sees things many white men pretend not to see. It makes him angry and pushes him toward action. Finally, as he crosses the border and is safely out of South Africa, he posts a letter that will make his private concerns very, very public. Who is his missive addressed to? The Sydney Morning Herald.
It laid out the issues that confronted us on the tour and raised the question of whether Australia should continue to play against South Africa. The Australian people had to decide whether they were willing to go on accepting that.
On October 8, 1969, Anthony's letters published with the headline, South Africa and Sport.
And I suppose it really had the effect of starting a horse race with a hand grenade.
Indeed, it does. Anthony's letter pressures sporting bodies to question the morality of playing whites-only South African teams. Does playing the South Africans give cover to their apartheid policies? This question is about to be put to the test. By the 1970s, a whole new language of black power is emerging. In America, it's embodied by the Black Panthers, and in South Africa, it's Steve Biko's Black Consciousness Movement. And in Australia, the epicenter of black rights is Redfern, the inner Sydney neighborhood that's become a hotbed of Aboriginal activism, pride, and politics. A powerful group of Aboriginal activists is based in Redfern. And one of them is Gary Foley. Gary is a Gumbangir man. Today, he's professor of history at Victoria University. But back then, he's helping set up Australia's first Aboriginal medical and legal services, as well as the Tent Embassy in Canberra, as well as a founding member of the Black Panthers in Australia. And he keeps hearing all about this white mob protesting apartheid, with his eyebrows raised.
Suddenly, in 1971, we started reading about these demonstrations that were being held in Sydney, near us, involving these Australian anti-racists. Now, this was a significant surprise to us because our experience up until then, we didn't think there were very many Australian anti-racists at all. I can only speculate that they found it more comfortable to be challenging racism that's a lot further away from their own backyard. Because once you start thinking about your own backyard, it's a different kettle of fish.
Marks are really piling up now as Australia awaits the arrival of the South African rugby team at the end of next week.
No means the end of disruption, because the anti-apartheid movement has organised itself to block games at such places as this Sydney sports ground.
By 1971, there's a slow drumbeat of opposition building globally against the apartheid regime.
There's a protesters' kit, which consists of a whistle, a clicker, a balloon with a slogan on it, and a protester's guidebook showing how to get in, how to...
But because of the Springboks tour, it's especially loud here in Australia. Trade unions, land rights activists, uni students, they're all joining forces. They're screaming at the top of their lungs about racism in South Africa. Gary Foley's curious about what this white mob has to say about this pressing social issue. So, the next time they protest, he goes along with his mate, another Aboriginal activist, the late Paul Coe. They're listening to the speeches, and suddenly Paul's had enough.
Paul Coe jumped up and commandeered the microphone and laid down a challenge to the Australian anti-racist. He said, you know, how is it that all of you people are here demonstrating about racism halfway around the world? What about here in your own country, you know?
Fair call, Gary. As you were.
What about here where you may have to sort of face up to the reality that you might be part of the problem rather than part of the solution, which is what you see yourselves as here with, you know, the demos against South Africa. And so we didn't really expect them to respond in any sort of way, given the nature of Australia at the time, but to their credit, they did.
So the anti-apartheid activists and the Black Rights Movement join forces to fight racism on all fronts. They're demanding land rights for Aboriginal people, and they're calling on the Australian government and rugby union to cancel the Springbok tour. They realize something important, that Australia and South Africa speak a common language, this crazy love and respect for sport. former Minister for Foreign Affairs, Gareth Evans. He supports the boycotts at the time, and he explains it like this.
Because we were a cricket and rugby playing country, we had the capacity to make an impact on South African public opinion, which was equally, at least in the white community, sport mad, including in those two sports. So I think it was perceived as a way of striking at the core of Afrikaners' sense of what they're all about and making them sort of focus on the indignities and the horrors.
In other words, Australia is uniquely positioned to strike a blow against apartheid. It has power. Another influential group is also forming behind the scenes, the Wallaby Seven. It's a group of former rugby internationals calling for a boycott of the tour, including Anthony Abrams and Terry Foreman. The Wallaby Seven pick up where Lloyd McDermott left off, refusing to be part of any team playing the white-only Springboks. They're pretty famous, so they get a heap of attention for their stance, including from Prime Minister William McMahon, who slams them, saying they're a national disgrace. Barry McDonald is another of the Wallaby Seven. In this news clip from 1970, he's just come off the field with Anthony Abrams. They're dripping with sweat and not holding back on how they feel.
So I think we all feel the same about it. I just can't see how you can possibly invite a side out here that chooses a side according to race and say that you're not endorsing their policies.
You know, South Africa won't let our Aboriginal sportsmen go there and play in South Africa. South Africa won't let people like Arthur Ashe play in South Africa. And if they're going to pursue these sort of policies, which underline sort of racial difference in the world of the 1970s, well, I think that we've got to be firm and say that politics have been brought into sport, not by us, but by South Africa, and we've got to do something about it.
Sadly, however, the PM has his finger on the nation's pulse. Polls show that 85% of Australians do think the tour should go ahead. They don't want to hear about all this apartheid stuff. The public is saying politics and sport, they don't mix. Huh. And so, the 1971 Springbok Tour of Australia goes ahead. On Saturday, the 26th of June, South Africa's all-white rugby union team touches down in Perth. Only to find protesters clashing with rugby fans at the airport. And when they get to their hotel, there are more demonstrators. And that's just a taste of what's to come. The tour becomes a moral battle between racism and anti-racism, between right and wrong, with one side insisting that sport is never just about sport. Trade unions across the country are in full activation mode. They've been talking to their South African counterparts for years, and now they have an audacious plan to disrupt the Springbok tour. Their first step? The unions ban members from working if the Springboks are on the plane. You'll most likely know Bob Hawke as our Prime Minister in the 80s, but back in 1971, he leads the very powerful Australian Council of Trade Unions.
Are you confident this announcement now can stop the South African tour?
Oh, you can't be absolutely confident in these matters, Gary, but my expectation is that it will mean that the South Africans will not be able to tour in Australia.
The unions have a lot of power. So when the ACTU says jump, its members say, how high? The major airlines won't be flying the Springboks anywhere. The team's forced to fly around the country on five tiny charter planes. And on the ground, transport workers refuse to let them onto trains and buses. Unions even make it hard for the rugby boys to get a feed.
And also the hospitality unions had bans on any establishment, any hotel or motel that they were booked into.
John Halfpenny is a senior unionist at the time.
And also they had to arrange accommodation in sort of small motels, sometimes in the homes of rugby union supporters at the time.
Just like high school students on a field trip, these high-flying international rugby players are billeted out, sleeping in the spare rooms of supporters. After weeks of protests at games around the country, the Springboks finally arrive in Sydney. The pressure's been building and the team has been feeling the heat. Because of that union boycott, the Springboks can't stay at the big-name hotels. So they're forced to secretly book at a random motel in Bondi Junction, the Squire Inn. It's inconvenient for the Springboks, but it's super convenient for Aboriginal activist Gary Foley and his mates in the Black Power movement, whose headquarters is, get this, just around the corner.
So we opened up the doors of our commune and that became the headquarters of the demos that took place while the Springboks were in Sydney. And
so it was purely coincidental, just pure luck?
Well, nobody knew where the Springboks were going to stay, but then suddenly one day we saw all these police at the motel next door, and when we sort of sussed out what was going on, we discovered here are the Springboks. And so we alerted the rest of the crew and everybody started having demos in front of the Springboks motel.
And guess who else lives just around the corner from the Squire Inn? Former Wallaby, Jim Boyce, one of the Wallaby Seven. Now, Jim had been on the 1963 tour of South Africa, and one moment was seared in his memory. After one of the games, the Wallabies had a meet and greet with South African politicians, and one of those politicians gave Jim three Springbok Guernseys, and he said,
"A black man will never play rugby for South Africa."
The guy who said this to Jim Boyce? He later went on to become the Prime Minister of the country. So yeah, anyway, I reckon Chester Williams, the first black post-apartheid Springbok, might have something to say about that. So might Siya Kolisi, the first black captain of the Springboks, and its most successful, I might add. I could go on and on and on. In any case, back in 1971, Jim Boyce is now mates with Gary Foley. He takes those three Springbok Guernseys and gives them to Gary.
And he brought them to us and he said the Prime Minister, John Vorster, had said that no black man would ever wear this hallowed symbol of Africanerdom, the Springbok football Guernsey. And Jim Boyce said to us, if you guys wear these things and the South African players see you, they'll hit the roof.
The audacity. This is brilliant. Gary Foley and a couple of mates put on the Guernseys and wear them to a protest outside the motel where the Springboks are staying.
The South Africans saw us wearing these things. The police came out of nowhere and dragged us into the Squire Inn, because the police thought that we had stolen these Guernseys from the current team that was staying in the Springbok. And so the police dragged us in there and they made all of the South African rugby players come down and parade past us, and they were saying, which one of you guys did these guys steal these jumpers from? And very quickly the police suddenly realised their mistake and the South African rugby players were not happy at all.
But again, these players ain't seen nothing yet.
Rival hookers, Van Wyk for the Springboks, and the veteran New South Wales captain, Peter Johnson.
It's game day, the 17th of July, 1971.
A lot of balloons coming onto the field at the moment.
And Meredith Bergman's just arrived at the revered Sydney Cricket Ground for the first match between the Australian Wallabies and the South African Springboks.
When you got to the cricket ground on the day, it was extraordinary. There were these huge, great barbed wire fences. And the only area that didn't have these was, of course, the members' stand and the ladies' stand.
Meredith's a sports tragic, and she'll go on to be a state Labor politician. But today, she's a young, daring, anti-apartheid activist who's known to the police. And so, she's in disguise, dressed up as a white South African woman.
I had organised with a sister and two other friends we dressed ourselves up as what we thought middle-aged Afrikaners had looked like, and I'm wearing these terrible daggy clothes and a black wig. Anyway, but the police were totally bamboozled and they let us in.
That's a Rosenblum.
To Australians, when a team runs onto the field and it's all white and you know that the country is 80% black, you can see very clearly what's wrong. It was such a clear case of terrible discrimination, and We thought that to the average Australian, that would be despicable.
But actually, most Australians aren't blinking an eye.
What's your opinion of the demonstrators as a whole?
You really want to know?
Hairy goons. Hairy goons, mate.
Gutter snipes. Out. Finished.
I think it's a shocking demonstration by a lot of radical lout.
The SCG is packed. It's been 6 years since the Springboks played in Australia. But strategically planted throughout the massive crowd are disguised activists like Meredith, there to disrupt the game when the time is right.
We were just sitting there talking to each other in what we hoped were Afrikaner accents. And the police in front of us, and we actually got them to move aside because we said we couldn't see properly.
As the game gets going, thousands of demonstrators flood in through the turnstiles. They're blowing whistles, they're chanting, they're booing, they're making an enormous racket. Then they start throwing flares and fireworks onto the rugby pitch. It's pure chaos, and in spectacular style, they achieve their objective. They've disrupted play. The fans in the stands are furious, but this is the cue for Meredith and her sister to make their move.
We jumped over the fence. We ran onto the ground. And the police that had moved aside for us, obviously horrified that these middle-aged Afrikaners were doing this.
A chance here. There's a demonstrator on the field. Out to the winger on the far side, Stegman. Stegman inside the 25, and a demonstrator has run right through the play.
I lay down in the middle of a scrum or a ruck or whatever they are. But my sister Verity got hold of the ball and kicked it. And the Bulletin actually called it the best kick of the season because it went right up in the air and sort of took ages to come down.
Out on the halfway line, and police are converging from anywhere.
The cops run onto the field and arrest Meredith and Verity with a particularly rough tackle. But they've made their point. The protest with an image of the women on the pitch is on front pages globally. Buoyed by the success of the Sydney protests, demo organizers are banking on even bigger protests in Brisbane. By the time the Springboks board their five tiny charter planes and fly to Queensland, Premier Joe Bjelke-Petersen is ready for a showdown with protesters. He makes a stunning announcement.
Joe Bjelke-Petersen, the Premier of Queensland, called a state of emergency to stop the demonstrations against the Games.
So in defence of the Games, in defence of the spring, in defence of white supremacy, a state of emergency was called in Queensland.
Yes, yes. And the number of police that were called out to each game, it was quite remarkable.
It's no surprise when things get really nasty. On Saturday, July 24th, protesters are gathered outside the Springboks accommodation, the Tower Mill Hotel, on the fringe of Brisbane's CBD. They're holding signs, they're blowing whistles. Again, they're making a lot of noise. So far, so good. Until an astonishing number of police arrive. Protesters are at the top of a hill, but when they see the cops moving toward them in such force, they panic and they start to run.
And the police chased the demonstrators down a hill, sort of cordoned them off in a particular area and just started beating people up. It was probably the worst police violence of the whole tour.
The demonstration is now getting quite violent. They're carrying quite a number away now. It's impossible to keep a tally, but there are screams of pain and cries of pain coming up from the crowd from time to time. Quite frankly, I can't see any reason why the police are arresting people.
More than 600 police swarm the protest. The Premier's given them carte blanche to be as aggressive as they need.
I got grabbed by some police officers.
Queensland's future Premier, Peter Beattie, is there protesting.
I got thrown to the ground and I ended up being carted off to hospital. And then I got charged with disorderly conduct. I mean, disorderly conduct, and I was running away from police. It made me suspicious of the system. It was a turning point for me. I think it was the catalyst or the event that actually encouraged me into full-time politics.
The police were five deep in places across the roadway. Some of them were wearing crash helmets.
What they did was just, they linked arms and they started pushing us down the hill, which, so people were kind of tumbling backwards and, you know, trying to get out of the way of other people.
I was just grabbed by a whole group of policemen, about 10 of them. They punched me, they stood on my feet, they hit me about the head, they wouldn't let me go, and then they pushed me off.
Did you expect this sort of action?
It's incredible, I can't believe it. You know, this is Australia, you know, you don't sort of think...
It was a watershed. It was a frightening watershed. It was a bit scary at the time. But out of that came an energy for change, a good energy.
Amongst the protesters are Aboriginal activists and organisations making a stand too.
The police were right in there behind us, like blue heelers with a mob of cattle, and we were running. The batons were out and my heart still... races at the memory of it, yeah.
The late Maureen Watson is there and says the police violence has a particular flavour if you're black.
There were Aboriginal people getting bashed up and being warned to get out of town. They were more or less given an open permit on Aboriginal people with the state of emergency.
It was a time of I guess, new awakening, new awareness in many senses, and people were expressing their democratic right. I mean, I'd never seen Indigenous activists before.
The police violence totally backfires. The public is horrified. As the Springboks board their flight home to South Africa, support for the tour is evaporating. With their strikes, whistles, flares, guernseys and placards, the demonstrators have sent a clear message to South Africans and the world. And it's damn impressive. When Meredith Bergman and co. started protesting the 1971 Springbok tour, they knew it was too late to stop it. But they figured their protest actions would get a lot of attention, because the plan was to build up to another fight, the upcoming South African cricket tour.
We did feel we could probably stop the cricket because it's such a more delicate sport.
Cricket's always been known as the gentleman's sport. It goes on for days and days and days. Don't get me started. That means players are more vulnerable to distraction. And of course, there's a lot more time to disrupt. Here's ABC reporter Mike Carlton with a few choice tips for maximum protester disruption.
Now, with the footballers, a fairly common tactic was the blowing of whistles, which confused the players about the referee's decisions. But with the cricketers, a far more effective tactic, I'm told, will be the use of pocket mirrors to effectively blind the batsman.
My absolute love of cricket had me horrified at the thought of breaking up cricket matches. But we knew this had to happen. If they were going to send us a whites-only cricket team, we would break it up.
Principle over pleasure. It's not just mirrors and whistles. There's a whole bunch of disruptive tactics Mike Carlton suggests. Blasting radios tuned to different stations, releasing grasshoppers onto the pitch, fleas into the crowd, the possibilities are endless. But in addition to her staunch opposition to apartheid, I suspect Meredith wants to spare her beloved cricket these miseries. So she gets to work campaigning to have the cricket tour cancelled. In 1971, Sir Donald Bradman is the chair of the Australian Cricket Board.
Sir Donald Bradman, I don't need to describe who he was. You know, it's probably Australia's most famous sports person.
But if, like me, you're a migrant, not a cricket fan, or just under the age of 50, then you need to know that Bradman was, well, is, an absolute legend, the greatest batsman of all time. And as the chair, he's deliberating whether or not the upcoming tour should go ahead. He's seen what happened with the rugby, and he does not want a repeat performance.
Anyway, one day I get this letter through the post.
Meredith is beside herself. The letter is from Don Bradman, her hero. And he wants to know why she thinks the cricket tour should be cancelled.
So he was trying to make out that there should be a exception made for cricket. Anyway, I wrote back, and I'm a very polite girl from Beecroft, so I wrote back very politely.
Very politely. but she clearly spells out why the tour must be cancelled. Meredith and Donald write back and forth for months. No quick texts in these days. It's paper and pen and postage stamps. And then one day, Bradman announces his decision.
He said, we will not play South Africa until the system of apartheid is finished.
Wow.
It was a wonderful thing to say. We were so pleased with it.
You could not ask for better.
It was terrific. Coming from Sir Donald Bradman, who was well known as a conservative force in Australian cricket.
It's a stunning victory. There will be no dramatic cricket protests, no mirrors blinding the batsmen, no police with batons as the gentleman's game unfolds.
I think he was astute enough to see that what had happened to the footballers would be awful happening to cricket, and that it would put cricket right in the middle of a terrible argument about race.
1971 has been a massive year for anti-apartheid activists in Australia. They've disrupted the rugby, the surfing, golf, tennis, swimming, any sport with the South Africans and their white-only teams. And the big one, they've completely blocked the cricket tour, proving that Australians can make a difference, in the most larrikin of ways, to issues they care deeply about. But there's another victory, a quieter victory, one that's taken place off the sports field. Gary Foley.
Suddenly the land rights demonstration started to be much bigger as more and more non-Aboriginal Australians were joining these marches. And as these marches got bigger through 1971, that dramatically increased the pressure on the Australian government.
Activists and the government are realising racism's racism. You can't fight it in another country without also cleaning up your own backyard.
I mean, it still horrifies me when I realise that while all this was going on and I was demonstrating against Vietnam and apartheid, children were still being taken away from their parents because of their skin colour. That was still happening.
Fighting against apartheid places Australian racism in stark relief. In 1972, just a year after the Springbok rugby tour, Labor comes to power. In one of Gough Whitlam's first acts as Prime Minister, he announces a new policy. Racially selected sporting teams will be banned from touring Australia. Whitlam also announces an inquiry into how best to grant land rights to Aboriginal people. They are small but such significant wins for everyone fighting against racism. Next time on Boycott, we head back inside South Africa, where the apartheid regime is cracking down harder than ever.
But it soon developed into a much wider expression of black anger. Hundreds died in the violence.
But it's being met with the rage of a generation that will not be silenced.
He made it quite clear that we had to fight for our own freedom. Black man, you are on your own.
Surviving the crackdown means taking massive risks.
Someone knew someone who was selling very dodgy documents, but these documents worked.
I'm Sisonke Msimang, and Boycott is a Rewind production for ABC Radio National.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.